based upon human dignity, the nature of a human person, that we protect certain human rights.
Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And then amongst these human rights, the very first one is going to be the right to life, and then the right to liberty, especially religious liberty, and then how freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly and association, how these things actually hang together or they fall together. That a society that doesn't respect the free exercise of religion also will tend not to respect freedom of speech or freedom of press or the right to life or rights of private property, that these civil liberties tend to hang together.
You can meet and hear Ryan Anderson making the case for our first freedoms at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent. Tomorrow, I begin meeting with members of the Senate, which plays an essential role in this process. I will tell each senator that I revere the Constitution. I believe that an independent judiciary is the crown jewel of our constitutional republic. If confirmed by the Senate, I will keep an open mind in every case, and I will always strive to preserve the Constitution of the United States and the American rule of law. Thank you, Mr. President.
That's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh talking about his judicial philosophy in accepting the nomination of President Donald Trump to fill a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. How will it go? Will we learn anything when the media circus winds up and lets loose and we get to hear senator after senator on that committee talking and talking and maybe even letting Brett Kavanaugh have a word in edgewise? The hearings will start after Labor Day to confirm or to not confirm Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. How will they go and how do they work? Joining us to answer some of those questions, John Malcolm, Vice President of the Institute for Constitutional Government and Director of the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, formerly served as General Counsel at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice's Criminal Division. John, welcome to Issues Etc.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You actually recommended Brett Kavanaugh for consideration for a Supreme Court vacancy some years back. Why was that?
Well, for all of the reasons that President Trump has nominated him now, Brett Kavanaugh is a dedicated public servant and an outstanding judge. So, you know, a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School, he clerked for two distinguished circuit court judges and then for Justice Anthony Kennedy, the justice whom he would replace. Then he did a fellowship at the Solicitor General's office. He worked in the Independent Counsel's office. He was a partner in a prestigious law firm. And then for most of the Bush administration, he served as a senior associate counsel and staff assistant to the president. And for the past dozen years, he's been on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is frequently considered, and I think correctly so, as the second most important court in the land, where he has written over 300 opinions and joined hundreds more that are brilliant in terms of their approach and fidelity to the law, incisive analysis, and I think he has all of the attributes to be an outstanding justice on the Supreme Court.
Can you explain the confirmation process to us? Just refresh our memory.
Sure. So the president nominates, and then the Senate can give its advice and consent. And then upon receiving that consent from the Senate, then the president appoints the judge and signs a commission. Requires a majority vote in the Senate. They used to be subject to a filibuster, but that was done away with during the confirmation hearings for Justice Neil Gorsuch. And so, you know, everybody is trying to game the system because it is very close in the Senate. I mean, with John McCain effectively out since he's in Arizona and unlikely to return to Washington, the Republican majority is but the slimmest of margins, 50 to 49, but it only takes 50 votes to get confirmed. And so the Democrats are very, very busily trying to peel away one or two Republicans to vote against the nomination. And the Republicans are not only straining to keep those Republicans in line, but also trying to reach out to some red state Democrats to persuade them to support the nominee as well.
Does advice and consent, that's the language of the U.S. Constitution.
Correct.
Does that mean that the Senate can turn a president's nomination away, or is that simply kind of the tradition of how the process has functioned?
Oh, they can certainly turn a president's nominee away, and there have been various instances of that. The one that people are probably most familiar with is when the Senate voted down Judge Robert Bork to be a justice on the Supreme Court, but there are many other examples of the Senate rejecting nominees. And of course, most recently, in the midst of a presidential election year, President Obama nominated Chief Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, and the Republican majority said, you know, we are not going to take up that nominee. We are declining to, you know, give our advice and consent. We're just not going to have a hearing because it's an election year and the Supreme Court is very much on the ballot. So, yeah, most nominees do get confirmed, but by no means all of them.
What are the criteria ordinarily when talking about whether or not a person is fit to serve as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I suppose the answer to that question depends somewhat in the eyes of the beholder. So to my mind, they are people who are solidly credentialed, that are well versed in the law through either prior experience as a judge or as an academic or in private practice or government experience. They are people, to my mind, who are textualists and originalists and who are going to apply the law as those laws were written and understood by the people who enacted those laws, that they're not going to attempt to pour into the law under the guise of interpretation, their own personal or political predilections to reach an outcome that they like, even though the law, if read with fidelity, would reach an outcome that they do not like. There are some people on the left who, with respect to Judge Kavanaugh, are trying to tie him down and get him to commit to uphold certain precedents that they happen to like and to consider overturning precedents that they happen not to like, even though Judge Kavanaugh should not comment on any case that is likely to come before the Supreme Court, because you never want to have a judge who is going to prejudge any case before a case is presented and the, you know, arguments of counsel are considered. Judges are supposed to be independent and fair and impartial people.
Is that part of the roadshow that is the confirmation hearings? People who watch them on television might notice that the senators do a lot of talking and the candidate sometimes does very little talking. Is part of that drama or that theater to get the candidate perhaps to say something that would be ill-advised for them to say during a confirmation hearing?
I don't know whether the histrionics that one frequently sees in the Senate Judiciary hearing room are geared towards trying to get the nominee to say something ill-advised, or whether it is more to play to the audience outside the chambers that may be watching to gin up support, public support, either for or against the nominee, or frankly, to help that senator's own electoral prospects.
What are you hearing by way of criticism of Brett Kavanaugh that catches your attention lately?
Well, you're hearing an awful lot of criticism, not only about Brett Kavanaugh, but also about the process. None of it particularly captures my attention, but you know what you're hearing is that he has this extensive record when he was working in the Bush White House, and therefore we can't have a hearing until we see literally every piece of paper that Brett Kavanaugh ever handled during his many years in the Bush White House. The same people who are demanding these documents are people who have already indicated that they're going to vote against Brett Kavanaugh, and they seem to have an aversion to actually reading the 300-plus opinions that Brett Kavanaugh has written, which are, of course, the best indication as to what kind of a justice he will be. Today, you are hearing the latest, which is certain people who are saying that we ought to put this thing off until after the Mueller probe is over because somehow it's connected to the Paul Manafort guilty verdict and Michael Cohen's guilty plea. I don't fully understand that, other than the fact that they're trying to, you know, say that there's a cloud over this president. I don't recall any of these Democrats making similar noises when they confirmed either Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer, even though those confirmation hearings took place under the cloud of Whitewater investigation, which was ongoing and involved then-President Clinton. And really what you're hearing is that somehow if Brett Kavanaugh gets in, that, you know, Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned and Obamacare is going to be struck down, so people with pre-existing conditions are going to be left worse off. I mean, all of these things, all of these statements are designed to completely politicize this process and to get Judge Kavanaugh to tip his hand as to what his biases are, when really what a judge is supposed to do is set his biases aside at the courthouse door and rule on the basis of the law.
How does the vote have to break down in order for him to be confirmed? Do the Republicans, you mentioned John McCain's absence, do the Republicans, if they vote together, have enough to confirm him?
Yes. So there are 50 Republicans in the Senate without John McCain there. And if all 50 Republicans vote for Judge Kavanaugh, he will become Justice Kavanaugh. And if one of the Republicans decides not to vote to confirm him, then the Republicans are going to have to look to get one of those red state Democrats to cross over. Some of these confirmation votes can be very close. Clarence Thomas, for instance, was confirmed by a 52-48 majority. And so, you know, here the margins are quite slim.
How likely is it for a Republican to defect from that particular vote to vote against confirmation, and how much of what we're watching right now is aimed at swaying those minds?
I think it's unlikely that one of the Republicans will vote against Judge Kavanaugh, but there is no question that the Democrats are spending an awful lot of time talking about the issue of abortion, an issue, by the way, that even if we had Justice Kavanaugh, I think the court would be reluctant to revisit anytime soon. But the reason that they're doing that is quite obvious, which is they're trying to appeal to either Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, because both of them are known to be pro-choice senators, and therefore they're trying to persuade them that Brett Kavanaugh poses an existential threat to abortion rights.
Are there Democrats in the Senate who are likely to vote for confirmation?
Very interesting question. So I think that if all 50 Republicans indicate that they are going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh and it is inevitable that he is going to be confirmed, that you might very well see some red state Democrats, Joe Manchin, Joe Donnelly, Heidi Heitkamp, crossing over, perhaps others like John Tester, less likely Claire McCaskill, but maybe. If, on the other hand, one of the Republicans indicates that, you know, she, since it would be likely Senator Murkowski or Collins, is not going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh, then the pressure on the Democrats to toe the line will be intense.
I'm curious, the nominee has been, since the announcement of his nomination, he has been visiting informally with members of the Senate. How is that part of the process?
Well, nominees frequently pay courtesy calls. Not every senator is a member of the Judiciary Committee. It's done. I mean, they're called courtesy calls for a reason. It's to show respect to the Senate for its vital role in the confirmation process. And it's also to give senators an opportunity to ask questions in a more private setting of the nominee and to sort of get a gut feeling for what the nominee is like. Sometimes these courtesy visits are for show, and I don't say that even necessarily to be denigrating, but people like Chuck Schumer and Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein have already come out and announced that there's no way they're ever going to vote for Judge Kavanaugh, so these hearings are more for show, but sometimes they are more substantive. Sometimes you will have senators who have legitimate questions or particular issues, and they want to learn more about a judge's judicial philosophy, and then those meetings can be quite worthwhile.
What do you think the main issues that will be raised at Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing? What are we going to hear about then?
I think that what you're going to get, a bunch of questions from Democratic senators who are going to say that because Justice Kennedy was often a swing vote, that this is a more pivotal position than any of the other positions, and that therefore the nominee has to be more forthcoming with his personal views on past precedents. And so, you know, they're going to ask questions of Brett Kavanaugh about Citizens United or the Heller case, which is a gun rights case, or Obergefell, the same-sex marriage case, obviously Roe versus Wade. He will in all likelihood decline to answer those questions, other than to say that they're entitled to the same respect as every other Supreme Court precedent, and they are going to rail about how unsatisfactory that is. And then you'll also hear questions about the process, the fact that they didn't get every jot and tittle in terms of documents that they wanted from the White House, and is he going to somehow protect the president if the president finds himself in legal jeopardy? Those are the kinds of questions that you are going to hear, and you know they'll criticize particular decisions that Brett Kavanaugh has written, and after you've written over 300, there are no doubt going to be some decisions that they happen not to like, and they'll try to blow that out of proportion.
I can't imagine, as a nominee, having to go back over 300 decisions you participated in and kind of boning up for that pop quiz, being able to kind of recall what it is you said or why you said that, or even the particulars of individual cases. This has to be an enormous intellectual challenge to any Supreme Court nominee.
Yes, it certainly is. But fortunately, Brett Kavanaugh is more than up to that task.
Do you expect to learn anything in the course of the confirmation hearing?
I'm not sure that I will personally learn anything, only because I've read an awful lot of Brett Kavanaugh's writings, both his opinions and speeches. He gave a speech at the Heritage Foundation last year on administrative law that has received a lot of attention. I'm not sure I will personally learn a lot, but I think the American people will, and I think that that is all to the good. They will learn what kind of an outstanding individual Brett Kavanaugh is, and they will learn what kind of an outstanding judge he is and what kind of an outstanding justice he will be.
You used the term a little earlier in our conversation, a textualist. What does that mean, and why is that so important?
So a textualist is somebody who reads statutes. The term originalist is often used for somebody who is talking about reading the Constitution and says, you know, Congress sometimes passes bad laws, but the policy judgments are not to be made by judges. They are to be made by Congress. And it is a judge's role to give the best interpretation to a statute based on the language in that statute, which is actually passed by Congress and signed into law by the president, and not to, under the guise of interpreting that statute, stray beyond it, perhaps citing to the congressional record, perhaps a speech that was given by a senator in the dead of night to an empty well where nobody else was there, in order to fashion the law as the judge might want it to be. So a textualist is somebody who applies the law based on the text of the statute and not anything beyond the text of the statute. And an originalist is somebody who looks at the text and structure of the Constitution and applies the terms in the Constitution and phrases in the Constitution on the basis of the original public meaning of that text, how it was understood at the time by the people who wrote that amendment or wrote the text of the Constitution, and how it was understood by the people who ratified those provisions.
I've talked with several guests about Brett Kavanaugh, about his nomination, about the process, and several of those have noted something about the landscape of the industry of law in the last 25 years or so. They've noted that the number of quality originalist lawyers and judges and jurists out there has never been better. The bench is very, very deep when it comes to good, sound, originalist lawyers out there. Do you agree?
Well, I certainly agree that the president has nominated some outstanding judges, many of whom have been confirmed, some of whom are still awaiting confirmation, and many of them adhere to a philosophy of textualism and originalism. I don't think that that is a particularly high priority for a Democratic president. And, of course, for the last 8 years prior to the Trump administration, we had President Obama, who tended to nominate judges who had more of, if you will, a living constitutionalist philosophy, those people who see the Constitution as changing over time to suit modern mores rather than being based on interpretations that are more originalist in nature. So I think that the President Trump has an excellent opportunity to appoint some originalist judges. He has done so. There are still some excellent judges who are left over from the administrations of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, and a few from Ronald Reagan. So there are a fair number on the bench, but we could use a few more.
You had mentioned the elimination of the filibuster for judicial nomination hearings. If that were still in place, would we be having a very different conversation?
A very different conversation. So Harry Reid, the then majority leader in the Senate, did away with the filibuster for judicial nominees, with the exception of Supreme Court justices. He did that in order to get three judges confirmed on the influential D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where Judge Kavanaugh now sits. And then last time around, when it was very obvious that Justice Gorsuch, or Neil Gorsuch, was an eminently qualified nominee and the Democrats were refusing to consider confirming him, I think the Republicans said enough is enough. If you're not going to confirm Neil Gorsuch, you're never going to confirm anybody. And therefore, since you took the step of doing away with the filibuster for all other judges except for Supreme Court nominees, we'll take this last small step.
John Malcolm is Vice President of the Institute for Constitutional Government and Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He formerly served as the General Counsel at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice's Criminal Division. John, thank you very much for being our guest.
A pleasure being with you.
On the other side of the break, we will be reviewing the movie The Meg. It's a shark movie, doubtless to be compared with the 1975 film Jaws. We'll do that with Pastor Ted Geese right after this.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
When you pray, give us this day our daily bread. What do you mean by daily bread? What do you really need to live? If you've ever puzzled over questions like these, you won't want to miss the August issue of The Lutheran Witness. With articles on downsizing, giving, and yes, what we mean by our daily bread, you're sure to come away with a more biblical view of wealth and poverty, possessions, and generosity. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.